Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Trail Culture. I'm your host, Em Robertson, and I'm so stoked that you're tuning in. Trail Culture is almost a year old. What a ride. This time last year, I'd started to record episodes. I was teaching myself to use all the equipment, to edit, making all the mistakes one could make, but honestly, loving every second. I've mentioned it over the last few weeks, but Trail Culture is going to be taking a production break. There's a couple of reasons for this, but the main one is that big things are coming for season two, and taking a break from releasing episodes will give me the space to make that all happen. So it will also give me some time to respond to comments, messages, guest suggestions, and just to improve the podcast experience on the various mobile and desktop apps. Having this as a hobby and a passion project means that certain things do take a backseat, but I really appreciate all the feedback and I'm stoked to get stuck in and improve the listener experience. I really do appreciate every single one of you that takes the time to listen to the guests and to what we've got to say. The season two guests and episodes are already lined up, and in the next few weeks I will still be recording. Watch the social media pages for some exciting sneak peeks at what's happening and for some behind the scenes content. I'll also be sharing some links and clips from previous episodes to give you all the chance to catch up on what you've missed as well. And I couldn't think of a better way to end off season one than with this trail science episode with Simon Duvall from Rooted in Dirt. I hope you guys enjoy the episode, and I will see you back here in September for season two of Trail Culture. Enjoy. Guys, welcome back. Another Trail Science episode. We met last month. We had a great comeback, because we had a little bit of a break with George Mutt and all of that from the trail science. So it's good to be back with Simon Duvall. He now has the upper hand with the sun making an appearance on that side of the pond. So he is in summer and in a t-shirt. And for those of you listening in South Africa, I'm sure you have a jacket on and a blanket. But
it's very rare that I get to boast about that. So I'll take that win. Thank you.
You're welcome. So yeah, Simon, thanks for joining us for another episode of Trail Science. And super cool. Simon actually has been away at a conference. And that's kind of been, it was actually difficult to choose today's topic just because of kind of what he was exposed to, the research that he got to see and listen to, and kind of the different people he was in conversation with. So that's always exciting, you know, how is research and the years of work playing out in the real world? Simon, tell us a bit about where you were and the conference, and what's happening in the sports science world in real time?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be accepted to present some data from my PhD at the European Congress of Sports Science, which was hosted, it's an annual conference, and this year it was hosted in Glasgow, which is not too far away from me over here in the UK. And I applied to present some data from my pacing analysis, which I think we've done an episode on, if I recall.
Go listen to it.
Yeah, call back to a previous episode. All of your listeners already know what that's all about, but the people at ECSS got to learn about it. And we were talking about this, I think, last week. I just felt it was really well received by the audience that came to attend my particular talk. And the thing that struck me the most was just how curious and passionate and enthusiastic the kind of audience were about trail running and ultra trail running. They just found it to be really interesting. And there is something about the culture of trail running that is just really, it's just welcomes people. I think most people that are in the trail running space are really approachable, even at the very highest level.
Yeah.
There's just kind of a really lovely kind of atmosphere. And I think it just draws that type of person. Even the researchers that I was speaking to in the trail running space, I just found like, oh wow, I'm just connecting with you. You're just my type of person, if that makes sense. And so it was really nice to get to present some of my own work and get some feedback from colleagues, people in sports science academia who I never would have met or known about if I didn't go there. But also to learn more about running science. So we're all, as much as we are academics, we are students as well, and we try to learn and glean as much information off of one another as possible. And yeah, there were a couple of things that kind of stuck out to me, and I don't want to go too much in detail on all of them. The one which we've talked about is female athletes and women in sport, and kind of invisible women in sports science. Where are they? Why do we not study them? What are some of the barriers to effectively kind of studying and measuring women in sport? And that's a really hot topic. And what was really interesting, there was a special interest group for female athletes, and I think about half of that room was filled with men as well. So I think it's not just women wanting to bang the drum and say, come on, we need to push this forward now. There are men that are getting involved as well. So that was really cool. And
Yeah,
I
that's
learned a lot of
awesome.
stuff to apply maybe through your PhD, Emily. So that's
Great.
cool as well. And then I basically spent my time between kind of measuring and monitoring female athletes. And then there was really like a special interest group and symposium on running science. There were loads of researchers there interested in running, and mostly in endurance. So I would say that a greater proportion of people interested in kind of long distance running as opposed to sprinting. But that could be everything from biomechanics to physiology. There was a huge amount of interest in physiological resilience and durability, which we can maybe talk about in a later episode.
I'm so keen.
Yes, well, we will talk about it, but I just got me thinking I need to be doing research in that space because it's such a hot topic. Andy Jones gave an invited talk on physiological resilience and the breaking two. Was it the Nike before the INEOS 159? I think it was Nike
Yeah, it
breaking
was
two
Nike.
challenge, and why Kipchoge was the one who stood out despite all of their candidates having very similar physiological profiles. There's something to do with how he handles fatigue, which is the key to performance in long distance events. So physiological resilience was huge, and what we're going to talk about today, power. Which in my talk, I had a question after I gave my pacing analysis and said, we need to consider other methods and other manners of prescribing pacing to our athletes and also doing pacing analyses in trail running. We cannot rely on absolute speed because of the variability in pace depending on the gradient. And then I had a load of people saying, well, what do you think? Like, what's the answer? And I kind of speculatively threw out power as a potential solution to the challenge.
And the whole room went
And
wild.
then there were a few people, and some people that are a bit skeptical, others that are already using power and are fully invested in this is the future, this is the way forward. So you kind of get a mix, and you stand up there on the podium, like just hoping you're not going to get grilled for something you said. But all in all, it was really interesting. I attended a few things in football, training load monitoring, which I have an interest in as well,
Yeah,
or
Simon's
soccer.
other love is team sports that
Yes.
involve a ball, hockey, soccer. Yes, we know.
Indeed. Yeah.
It's the other
But
children next to trail
they
running.
were, yeah, they were not the main focus. Yeah, it was really good. It was just nice to start to establish some of my own kind of research networks in the UK as well. So really good
Excellent.
experience.
Just on that, Simon, I think you mentioned Andy Jones being there, and he was part of kind of the breaking two. And just the kind of intersection of people who are in the research space, but also in the real world space. I think that's something that, we actually were in a meeting earlier that this came up, but it's not just, we can't just have, having coaches or people in the industry, in sports media, in the space, either, doing the sport or whatever that looks like, or just having researchers who we hide in the lab or behind our books. We have to have this like intersection where science and the real world kind of collide. And I think that's a really great space. So it was cool for me to hear that you were meeting people who are presenting research, giving talks, doing things, but who are saying, okay, well, this is what I tested and saw or observed, and this is how I've since applied it in the real world.
Yeah, I think someone like obviously Andy is kind of a legend in the physiology space, exercise physiology, and particularly in the running space. And he's kind of like way above my pay grade. So you just sit there and you just listen and you're just
In
thinking,
awe.
wow, this is amazing. But it is about bridging that gap. And I think nowadays, I can tell you just from being in academia, there's just as much weighting and importance placed on research findings dissemination as there is on doing research and generating outputs and things like that. It's not just about generating those outputs anymore. It is also about, okay, now that you've done the research, can we try and garner some change in practice? Can you show us some evidence that what you've done has led to some changes in, I don't know, policy or co like best practice for coaches? Like, are you working with any federations to translate and disseminate those research findings? So those things are really important as well.
I think it's so cool for me. I mean, that there are those moments, because something that's, I think, a frustration for all researchers, and then in the same cycle, it's frustrating for kind of the consumer of the research, is the speed at, or like how long it takes to complete kind of good, like high top quality, like reliable, sound, kind of through the scientific method styled research. And then I think it's hot. It sometimes feels like things are progressing faster than the science can keep up with, but we need the science to make sense of the progression that we're seeing. So I
They
think
do, and
that's,
I had a conversation with I'm not going to say who they were, but they are a kind of a player in the apparel and shoe manufacturing space. And we had a very frank and open conversation because they were interested in my research, and I was obviously like, come on, let's do some collaborative research kind of thing. And their head of kind of innovation and sports science said he would love nothing more than to collaborate. That would be great, and I'm sure we will do some collaborative projects going forward. However, the speed that they need to move at to keep in step, no pun intended, with their competitors is so quick that they've worked with some really top researchers in the past, but there comes this point of frustration where they need to go to market. This product needs to go now. And they're still waiting on somebody to do the statistical analysis or the data processing, or it becomes a really complex thing. And we can talk about this within the scope of power meters and how we measure that kind of thing, but we see exactly the same thing. We are still doing validity and reliability studies on technologies that were launched close to 10 years ago, and we're still trying to figure out, are they valid and reliable? Meanwhile, we've already had multiple iterations and versions of these technologies that have been updated. Their algorithms have been changed, all of that in that time. We just don't move quickly enough. And one thing I when I went to the special interest group on running science, one thing I said, maybe we can try and achieve through this special interest group is to come up with like kind of position statements on what are the technologies that have been validated that we know are reliable. What should they be used for? How should they be used responsibly? And we can say, right, yes, I understand that, and I'm using Garmin as an easy way out here, but yes, I
Yeah.
understand that the Garmin Fenix 3 is reliable for measuring step count. However, we're now on Garmin Fenix 7S Plus Sapphire Gold Titanium, and we don't know about that yet. So we don't
Yeah.
know if that's got if that has been validated. The developers of the technology will release all sorts of white papers, and they'll say we've tested this. And I'm not trying to doubt that, but it's obviously also in their best interest to state that their equipment is valid and reliable.
Yeah.
Like with Stryd, these power meters, who when they initially brought it to market, it was already in the market and people were using it, but only years later did they make adjustments for wind resistance or drag, to which had a massive ramification on the actual power readings you were getting, but
Yeah.
people were still, they were already using it by that stage. So
Yes,
I
yes.
think there's a lot that we can do better to try and move quicker to validate new technologies, but that is an ongoing challenge in the space.
Yeah. I don't have the solution yet. In some ways, I'm like, I'd like the industry to slow down, and that's more linked to my opinions about overconsumption and human beings.
Yeah.
But anyway, I doubt that it will. And so in some ways, I think it's on us to create or have opportunities in the space to match the speed that the industry is moving at. And so
Yeah.
if
Well,
we want.
they move at consumer demand at a rate that matches the consumer demand. So if we say, right, well, we're only going to use products that have been independently validated and assessed for accuracy and reliability, we're not going to purchase new technologies until we know that, then all of a sudden they kind of don't have a choice. However, we're basically shouting into the wind here because people will buy the Garmin Fenix
Because
Sapphire. Looks
it's
so
shiny
beautiful.
and new.
You know, why
Yes.
would you not buy it? kind of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah,
Yeah.
it is a challenge, but hopefully what I would like to get out of it personally is to kind of make recommendations to people or have people ask, like, what do you use or what would you recommend, and how do we use this in the right way? So that we don't make some kind of basic mistakes when we use these technologies.
Yeah.
And also just know the limitations of the technologies as well.
Yes. And those are important questions to ask. I think you can apply that to anything in your life. You know, where does this come from? What are its limitations? Who designed it? What is, yeah. So, but I think, yeah, Simon, you mentioned that there's lots going on. It's exciting. We're going to cover many things in the next couple of weeks, which is awesome. But yeah, one of the things that, or how we decided on this is today we're going to talk about power. And
Yes.
largely, Simon is going to tell us a lot of things that he knows. And I am going to use my example of why I was skeptical about power as, you know, and
Yeah.
using it to kind of as a performance measure or training measure in the space of trail running. And that's largely because of my introduction to it, and then I didn't have kind of the know-how of how to reconcile what I was seeing with, you know, how it should be applied. That was a challenge for me. So Simon is gonna
Yeah.
take us through that. Simon, tell us, what is power? With great power comes
Comes
great
great
response.
responsibility. Yeah, well, I want to, the first, I'll get into what power is and we can talk about it a bit more broadly, but I think the first caveat that I want to throw in here is that I'm not an expert in this space of power and trail running, and I think that there is a small handful of people who are doing, you know, actively engaged in research in this space.
Yeah.
But I do consider myself an expert on wearable technologies in general and, you know, the applications thereof and kind of considerations for their use in
Yeah.
practice. So I just want to caveat that before I might have some people jumping down my throat based on things that I say.
And Simon, actually,
Yes.
before we even get into what is power, like I just want to paint the, we're going to go big before we zoom in. And why
Yeah.
we care about this and why we're talking about this is we've seen a big kind of shift in the trail running space. I mean, every time you see videos of pros, you see a new glucose monitoring device or some sort of wearable tech, and then everybody
Yeah.
goes, oh, what is that? And there's like an edgy video that's posted that's like a sneak peek. And
Yeah.
one of these items or pieces of wearable tech that we've seen are kind of power meters, which I think generally have kind of found their home in endurance sport in the cycling realm, are now moving into the
Yes,
running
yeah.
space. And the application in road running is much more straightforward than in trail running, and we'll get there. But essentially, what we want to talk about is power in the trail running space and the Stride pods. I'm using that because that's the one like kind
Yeah.
of brand that I know, just like you spoke about Garmin. But
Yeah.
why are people wearing them on their shoes in the trail space? Should we care about it, and is
Yeah.
it doing what it needs to do? So
Well,
that's
there's
the big
not,
picture.
I think
And
also it's going to sound like we're picking on Stride, but that's also for good reason because Stride, from what I've read, is probably the most researched kind of available to the public power meter for runners. And so
yeah.
because and they were a very early player in that space, and so there's been more research on them. And there's a paper which we can maybe post in the show notes. I don't know it offhand, which showed that Stride is a more reliable measure of power than some other wearable technologies in the space, like the Garmin power metric, I hate to say it.
Yeah.
So, I think as much as we're going to maybe talk a lot about Stride, we are also talking like more broadly about power meters, and Stride is obviously one such power meter.
Yeah.
But in terms of like the general biomechanics, let's say this is like sports science 101, I suppose. Powers is something that is a useful measure in sport. It's essentially a measure of work,
Yeah.
and otherwise, like how intense an effort is. You can measure many other things for that are kind of proxies for power or similar to power. So you could measure speed, that's a measure of intensity. You could measure the metabolic rate, whether that's kilocalories consumed or heart rate or oxygen uptake or even RPE is a measure of intensity, right? Rating of perceived exertion. So they're all sorts of measures that we can use, but they all have their own flaws. And the reason why power is interesting in the trail running debate is because work is affected by a number of things. So power is typically measured by force multiplied by velocity. And so if you've got a high degree of force that you're applying to something, and that could be to the ground, in the case of running, you're applying force to the ground. And if you're applying that force at a high rate, in other words, you're moving at a high velocity, then you have inflated or a larger power output. So velocity is distance divided by time. So if you're covering a large distance in a small amount of time, then you have a higher velocity. And obviously, if you multiply that by the force, you get power. And I think it's interesting in the trail running space because we've seen from some literature that's kind of coming through that when you do trail running, and this is not rocket science, so you don't need to sit down for this, but when you do trail running, you need to slow down considerably when you go up hills, and you tend to accelerate considerably when you go down hills. And so that velocity changes quite a lot during trail running, and the force changes as well. So typically that force, and this is where power is difficult in running, is if you look at the gait cycle, there's kind of a net mechanical power output, because initially when you land on contact, there's a lot of force absorption or attenuation, which is almost like the loss of force, but that still results in metabolic work. So you can imagine you're still having to absorb that impact. Your muscles are still contracting, although predominantly eccentrically. And then when you move through that like stance phase, that mid stance phase to toe off, all of a sudden you're doing positive work, okay, positive mechanical work. And that's where we can measure kind of power output. But power output in running is very different to power output in cycling. There's a lot more variables that come into it.
So I think that's before I ask you lots of questions about road and trail running versus trail running in terms of power, just so I think a lot of what we know about how the power kind of
Comes from cycling.
wearable tech was developed comes from cycling. So why is like that an important kind of piece of information to have in the puzzle? Like, why does that make a difference when we're looking at how the data we're reading is applied in the running space?
So power, so I said it's measure of it's measured through force times velocity, and normally power is given in watts. And watts is a measure of how many joules per second. So 1 watt equates to 1 joule per second. And joules are, and this comes from, I think, in my high school science from a electricity background. But joules refers to kind of the energy required to fuel that exercise bout. So when we measure dietary intake, we measure in calories or joules, so kilojoules or kilocalories. And there's a multiplication that needs to take place to kind of convert between joules and calories. But right at the end of that equation, we can actually measure what the energy demand is for a certain activity if we know the amount of watts expended per hour. So energy in kilocalories is equal to your average wattage multiplied by the duration of the session. Maybe you cycled for an hour, multiplied by the average power output. Maybe it's 100 watts, let's say. And then if you multiply that by 3.6, you convert it from joules to calories. And so we can kind of, and again, it's all about energy output, right? We're trying to get a measure for what is this person doing? What are they being exposed to when they are doing this exercise activity? And that also has ramifications for nutrition and how we need to refuel and replenish while we exercise or after we exercise, based on like the amount of calories or kilojoules that have been burnt.
I have many questions.
Let's start with those questions.
Great.
I've got the cycling. I think we can talk a bit about cycling before we come back into the running, but start with your questions.
So this is I'm going to continue on the cycling train. So kind of what you've just discussed now, Simon, it's wanting to understand like how much effort is going into the session that this person is doing, whether it's a race, whether it's training, and that's like multiple, like how you define effort can have multiple different definitions, but say in the joules, the calories consumed. So all the runners are immediately pricking up their ears and going, okay, but that's great because knowing how much I need to eat on a
Is
run, something like
useful.
an ultra. So we've got, I know with the, I think when people think power, I always think of the 100 meter sprint at the Olympics. It's like, those, that sort of measurement. But now what we're wanting to do is have the sustained continuous effort. And you spoke about slowing down, but we still need to eat. But before we get to that, for anyone who doesn't know, the Tour de France is currently on. I hope you're
It
watching. And
is.
something that I've seen and the commentators this year have been like really going on about, and they've actually been showing on air kind of some of the old footage of how the guys used to in the back in the day, like stop on the side of the road, throw down their bike, run into the nearest pub
Get
and
some
get a
beers.
beer, and then put it in their jersey and continue. So I think where I'm going with this is now, if you watch the Tour de France, you've got guys and girls in the cars giving the cyclists their bottle, which is like measured to the like milligram, this whatever the smallest unit of measurement is, that is the perfect concoction, like little cocktail of food and carbohydrate for their weight, their power output, that stage in the race because they've got all of this information, you know? So
And
it's like,
all of this comes from profiling these athletes in like critical power tests, where
yes.
these cyclists will do a variety of tests from very short duration, could be 6 seconds, 15 seconds, and then slightly longer, 30 seconds, 1 minute, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. And they what they'll end up generating is a critical power profile. And
Yeah.
they'll know what is a sustainable, still at a high intensity, but like what is a sustainable effort for the cyclist, and what is an unsustainable effort? When are we tapping into anaerobic reserves? Maybe you're talking about the
Yes.
final kilometer sprint before the
Yes.
finish line or whatever. And the fueling strategies will be based on, and this is the reality with cycling, is you get so much of a wind resistance benefit from being in the rear. Don't quote me on this, but I believe it's almost 100%. It's about 96%. It's somewhere in the region of 90%. If you're sitting at the back of a peloton in the middle,
Yes.
in just in terms of the wind resistance benefit, you experience 96% less air
Yeah.
resistance. And so cycling truly is a team sport whereby you've got to
Yes.
share the load of the work in front. And
Yeah.
so what the guys are doing at the back is they're just fueling. They know what they are able to sustain for long
Yes.
periods of time, and they're matching that in terms of their cut, or they're trying to match it as best as possible in terms of their caloric intake. And really in cycling, the difference making between the very best and just below them is in these moments of critical power. So it's in the moments where you decide to do a breakaway and try and put some distance between
Yes.
yourself and the peloton, or it's in the moment of the last kilometer of a mountain stage where you're trying to get ahead of the pack, and
Yeah.
hopefully that it doesn't come down to a sprint because you've put enough time between them, or it's in the last 100 meters where everybody's dashing for the line and it's a sprint. So it's a challenging. It's challenging to compare the two sports because running is not like cycling. You don't get
Yeah.
the same benefits by running in a pack as you do from
Yes.
cycling in a pack.
So I think that was my like follow-up question. But for those just quickly on the sprint thing, if you don't understand how the Tour de France works, I'm like go and find like one of the like whims who loves cycling, like my dad, and he'll explain it to you. But or go and watch Mark Cavendish, little South African plug, win his like the most sprint finishes that happened the other day. It was amazing to see. And that's that critical power moment where he just kind of the teamwork happens. He did a breakaway and managed to win. Anyway, it
I
was
feel
very
like I didn't
exciting.
know that is there Mark Cavendish South African link? How do I not know
Simon, it's gonna be okay.
that? Okay. I know that he won, is it 37 stages now? And he's the most ever
yeah, he's
stage wins. And but
yes.
anyway,
Yes. So
I
everyone's
need to
like,
learn about
I
the South
think it's one of
African.
these things. It's like Roger Federer, South African.
Right.
Yeah,
Okay.
anyway, we'll take it. We are good at
Cool.
stuff. But I think that's my question, Simon, is like now we see the benefits of understanding power and the kind of say in
Yeah.
something in an endurance sport like the Tour de France, we've got the critical power. And now you've just pointed out and how that relates to end stage performance,
Yeah.
after all the work that's been done. So now
Yeah.
we're looking, is do you think this is why this has become an attractive, like the draw for runners in general, like before we even get into trail runners, is this, are we hoping to
Yeah.
understand power output in running in the same way that we understand it in the cycling world?
I hate to say it because I'm a very reluctant cyclist. And I'm loath to say that I've learned anything from cycling, but I have learned a lot from cycling. I think so. I think the principle is the same, right? We want to have a better way of measuring and assessing athlete energy expenditure or athlete, work intensity. And in trail run, in marathon running, I can tell you pretty much speed is power is interesting, but speed is a pretty good measure because
Yeah.
most marathon courses are pretty flat and they're relatively similar. you might have some considerations if you're doing a marathon at altitude, or if there's like a headwind or something like that, that would affect your critical speed, the velocities that you move at, maybe have a bit less of an impact on your power profile, which we'll talk about. But yeah, we want to learn and adopt and take things on that will help us understand our sport better. And the reason that I got into this whole thing with all of these people at ECSS was I said maybe we should be using power as a better way of managing our pace and our efforts during ultra trail marathons. Now, if you want to say, right, I can, if you know that a sustainable, again, if we're using a 5 zone or a 7 zone model, like a zone 1 or a zone 2, low aerobic, easy, sustainable, in terms of metabolism, if we want to know what the if we can determine what the equivalent wattage is, power output, then it doesn't matter if I'm hiking up Buttercup Gorge or if I'm running down Nursery Ravine or if I'm running on a flat section on the top of Table Mountain. If I am able to see what my current wattage is, then I know that I'm working within that sustainable range for this ultra marathon.
Yes.
And
So just
so
like you
that's where
work
the value is.
within, and just like you work within your thresholds, like at the, I know a lot of people, for example, follow heart rate, and they you're looking at, you're basing your kind of work on, am I within a range? Despite we know so many things that affect this, your if you're taking in caffeine, you know, if the kind of other stresses on your body, there's loads. And then we've tried to kind of couple that with RPE to be like, you know, follow a bit more of your intuition and how you're feeling rather than just looking at the heart rate. But now, so this is the next step,
So
right?
here's the
Because
kicker with
now,
heart rate, because heart rate is great. However, the heart responds differently to uphill and downhill running. And so
yes. If
I
you
might
don't know
want,
that, go and do a VK and then see what happens.
exactly, but I might want to say, right, well, okay, I'm not going to rely on pace anymore because pace very obviously is affected by gradient. But the mechanical cost or demand of uphill running is significantly greater. There's greater demand on the kind of prime movers involved in triple extension, the concentric muscle actions, moving the center of mass against the force of gravity, results in an increased oxygen demand to those muscles, and our heart needs to pump faster to deliver oxygenated blood to the muscles. And so we see a very, very quick spike in heart rate when we start to go uphill. And so we could say, right, well, at the moment, and that's how I've been training my clients in the past. And I've said, yeah, well, and they always come back to me and they say, oh, should I walk this hill? And I say to them, what does your heart rate zone say? Well, heart rate zone says I should be walking this hill because if I start running, it's going to exceed the zone that I'm supposed to be training in.
Working in, yeah.
However, when they run downhill, the heart rate doesn't respond in the same way. So downhill, you've got much greater vertical ground reaction forces. So the strain on the musculoskeletal system is much greater. You've also got to attenuate those forces. You've got to control your body moving downhill. So you've got to absorb those impacts. And while that creates, and anyone who's done an ultra marathon, and I know this by through coaching, especially if they're quite new to the sport and they've not done it a lot, is the thing that slows them down on those downhills later on in the race is just they are so sore. They're just not able to continue moving at a certain speed. Do you think their heart rate is still sky high then? No, it actually drops to kind of mirror that output, that demand. And so that's the nice thing about power is it's a measure of force and velocity.
Yes,
Now,
so you're accounting for, yeah.
I mentioned earlier that we typically, when we measure power, we're looking at the net positive work. So this is one of the challenges. But if you imagine we're looking at positive work, so we're looking in that toe off, right? We've now gone through the mid stance and now we're measuring what that power meter is measuring is it's measuring the positive work being done. When I'm going uphill, the velocity of movement reduces. Okay. Because the amount of distance that you're covering over that amount of time becomes less, but the force required to move the body is much greater. Okay, so we can maintain a steady wattage, let's say, if we even if we slow down, because the force required to move the body uphill is greater. Now, when you're going downhill, the velocity of the movement increases, but the net positive force is much less, because we're actually using gravity to help us get down the hill. And so there, I think if we're using wattage now, we're saying, right, well, we are getting to a point where it's a little bit more of a fair comparison to compare uphill level and downhill running. And I wouldn't ever use power in isolation, but I do think as potentially like a live metric in conjunction with my heart rate, I think that those two together could be, or my RPE, my rating of perceived exertion, those two together could be really valuable in helping us with our pacing.
And I think that's in the beginning I mentioned I was skeptical. I feel like that's like something research has taught me in a good way, to be skeptical, to at least not take everything just at face value. You go to a social run and all of a sudden you see everybody has these pods on their shoes and this is the next big fad. And I was like, how are you, where does this, like, all my questions, like, where does this come from? How is this being applied in this sport? How are you going to compare apples? Something you always say to me, Emily, are you comparing apples with apples or apples with oranges? Like, understanding if you run, say you join Steady Shakeout, you run your route with your stride pod, and also you've taken it out the box and you've done no calibration or any sort of thing, and you just stick it on your shoe, off you go, and then you go, great, this is how I'm going to now determine whether I'm making progress in training or not. I think my first reaction to that, and people are very excited and you also don't want to be a killjoy, but I was like, I don't think that's the best idea. And then I kind of just avoided it for a little while, and I saw it being kind of applied here and there in very strange ways. So I must be honest, when we chatted and Simon was like, power, I was like, oh no. But now I'm like, it's encouraging for me to hear that research and what's going on out there saying use this in conjunction with other metrics, your heart rate, your RPE. But I think, Simon, I don't know if you can remember something you and we wanted to touch on this now, is what when you're running with power and you're saying, like, if you can understand, your watts and your output, and you're looking at an ultra, everything we've spoken about in the past is looking at an ultra like a tank of fuel. It's about, if it's pacing or nutrition, you're trying to, best, like, have good practice in managing your fuel consumption along the way so you don't run out of petrol before you get to your destination. But something you mentioned was about oxygen cost and looking at it. Can you take us through that? That was just so interesting for me, where I think everyone goes power and my first thought is like foot, like the foot contact with the ground, like how much power, or I think of something exploding also. I think just if you can bring that in for us to I mean, you've explained it in an amazing way now, but just like not, we're not looking at power just on its own.
What are the researchers doing in the space is a good question. So there's been some kind of recent publications in the space that the stride, and now again, it sounds like I'm picking on stride, but stride is obviously the main player in the space. The paper I was referencing earlier that looked at different kind of devices for running power output estimation compared Polar and Polar V stride devices, Garmin running power, RunScribe. So there are other kind of players in the space, and they found that the stride device was the most sensitive technology for running power measurement. And so it sounds like we picking on stride, but we're not. It's just because more people are researching about them, and there is good evidence out there that these stride power meters are reliable, And it comes down again to the difference between validity and reliability. So there's evidence recently published, well, in 2020, about the validity of stride power meters in measuring running parameters at submaximal speeds. And what they found is that the stride power meter provides a valid measure of ground contact time and leg spring stiffness. Now, ground contact time and leg spring stiffness are related to power output. They're related to efficiency and economy. We know that if you've got a higher vertical leg stiffness, that you've got less vertical oscillation, and therefore you don't waste as much energy. So you're typically considered to be more efficient. The same with ground contact time. Again, it's not a linear relationship. It's not like if you just keep going higher and higher, you're just going to be more and more efficient. They've kind of got a curvy linear relationship. But these stride meters were found to be valid in their measures of ground contact time and leg spring stiffness. That is comparing it to a gold standard. So something like an Optogate, which you might be familiar with, where we are able to measure these things with a high degree of accuracy. We then go and correlate what we get from the stride with what we get from like a known gold standard measure. And then we say, right, it's valid. It does measure what it intends to measure. However, we also know that the stride meters tend to underestimate absolute power output. So they're actually providing you with a lower power output than what you think you are producing. We can talk about maybe why that is later, but one of the cool presentations I attended was a professor here in the UK who does research with stride meters, and he said he doesn't really care if it's a valid measure. He said if it underestimates power output, it underestimates power output. Unfortunately, we as researchers have no input into what's inside that black box. What is inside this 9 gram little thing that you put on your lace, and how does it compute power? But how does it get to a measure? We can't change that. However, what we
That's what's
can do
available.
is we can measure oxygen demand. So if we measure oxygen uptake or oxygen demand at various submaximal levels, at different gradients, uphill, downhill, and we know what the nature of the relationship is between the power output and the oxygen demand, then we can model what the oxygen demand is at a given power output for that stride meter. And we can say, cool, well, we don't actually need to know the exact power output as long as we know what the equivalent oxygen demand is. And oxygen demand is a gold standard for energy expenditure or effort in endurance sports. We just can't measure it in competition because no one wants to run around with a gas mask and a portable cardiopulmonary
Imagine.
exercise test on their back. That's just not going to happen.
Maybe
So
we could get Courtney to do it since she's so far ahead of everyone else that she would be willing to do
Yeah,
that,
well,
Simon.
we can try and simulate it, and I think in research, and we can do time trials and things like that, but it's just not going to fly in a race, let's be honest.
No. That's really cool, Simon. I think I'm just full of questions today, but my next question is around the environment. Again, so now we've spoken about cycling, we talked about the peloton and wind resistance and working as a team, and you mentioned, that doesn't apply, for runners. Like, it doesn't make sense to try and run. Imagine, like UTCT, and then all the 100-miler runners are trying to run in a pack. It's just not, that doesn't make sense. But in road running, it's a predictable environment in terms of surface. If you're looking at something like the kind of whole going sub two, it's a very flat course. They look at the wind, they look at the like temperature, precipitation, they take all those things into consideration. And then if you think of any typical trail running race, if you've ever run and the weather is just stunning from start to finish, then I'm very happy for you. But like most of the time, you've got elements, you've got surface changes, you've spoken about altitude, there's lots. But in terms of actually the kind of environment that's not controlled in like a lab, any comments on that, like where the power, like
Yeah.
where the power meter and the kind of technology is developed versus the environment in which it's being applied. I think that's my, how are
Yeah.
we kind of accounting for that? You know, your wind, not just the gradient changes, but wind resistance on the surface and those sort of things.
Yeah, no, there's so much to get into there. Stride actually released a white paper on adding air resistance costs to their power estimates in running. It's titled "Running Against the Wind."
That's cool.
And so, when they initially released their like first gen running pods or whatever, there's certain things that they have, and again, we don't know what the algorithms say, but there's certain things that are computed into the algorithm to try and estimate. And again, I will go back to this is an estimation of power, and this is maybe a long way around about kind of. Have I lost you there? No, I haven't.
No,
Sorry, I thought I
I'm
lost
still
you.
here.
I
I'm just
flew.
listening.
Okay. So the joys of working online. This is one of the kind of challenges of like taking something that's developed very much in the cycling world and then trying to apply it to running. Is in bicycle power meters, we're measuring a direct force that's being applied to either like the pedal, axle, or the crank arm. And that normally uses a strain gauge, and we can measure mechanical power output because there's constantly kind of force that's being put into that crank. And the faster we pedal, that indicates a greater velocity, and the
Yeah.
more force we put in, right, that equals more power output. And because bicycles have the benefit of riding in groups where you can minimize the drag, the wind resistance to a huge extent if you cycle in groups, but also because they move relatively freely over the ground. And again, I'm being maybe disingenuous here because mountain biking is very different to road biking, but the friction that you get off the ground is not a huge cost on the metabolic demand of cycling. You know, the bicycles are very well geared towards translating that force that you put into the crank into horizontal force. It's very different when we get into running. And
Yeah.
so what the Stride pods are using, and this is good practice, is they do use body weight and height in their algorithms. So the very first thing you need to do if you're using Stride as a measure of power output is you need to update your weight on a regular basis, and you need to get an accurate height. How they use that data, I don't know, but obviously we have to accept that the mass that you are moving is primarily the force that you're trying to translate up the mountain, right? So an accurate body mass is really important. But the early iterations, like I said, they didn't account for, but what are the other things that affect the power output in this gait cycle? And one of those things is weather, right? Another one is gradient. Again, larger positive gradient means we require more force to move the body. And so they're obviously in their initial algorithms, I'm sure they were accounted for that, but they in their own white paper admit that, you know, they didn't really, not, I don't think they maybe didn't consider it, but it wasn't included in their algorithm how drag might affect your power output. And so if there's a headwind, we have to, obviously the speed of movement might slow, but we might still be maintaining the same power output because we're having to translate more force into the ground to move ourselves forward.
Yeah,
Even
greater
though our.
energy expenditures, the requirement is still there despite, you know, your
Yeah.
speed not necessarily reflecting that. Yeah, I
Yeah. And
think
then they brought in, and they call them like MEMS, which I think is like micro sensors or whatever, that they kind of say right now we've actually accounted for average wind speed over land across the globe and in certain areas. But I
Oh,
think
wow, that's cool.
these, you know, they are algorithms in the sense of they're meant to capture the average really well. But when you start to get outliers, then it becomes maybe a little bit more challenging.
I think where are we now, 2024? Was it last year? Yeah, UTCT 2023. Anyone who did the Milo will have lots to tell you about wind resistance, and that classic southeaster that blows in Cape Town. But Simon, I think my next question is, like, okay, so we know all of this, and if you say you're running a trail race and you're using, you've got like power as kind of one of the metrics that you're looking at, and it's important on the same level of importance as like your heart rate or your RPE, and then you have something like wind resistance, and you're aware, my energy expenditure is now kind of the same, for I'm getting less bang for my buck right now. Like, I should be doing this, and like I've got this plan and this much food. And I feel like in cycling, it's a more controlled environment, where let's take the Tour de France again, where the how your problem solving strategies are, I think, like easier to execute in that space. So I think, I guess my question is, like, if we're considering power and everything's going wrong in terms of the kind of environmental aspects that we can't control, what then? What do we do? What do we do? Are we still looking at power? Are we, do we
It
have to
raises a
kind
good
of,
question. And I think here's where the research is missing. So Stride says they use, I said MEMS, micro electromechanical system sensors, to determine what the kind of overground or relative airspeed is acting on the runner. I watched Courtney Dowalter break her Hard Rock record over the weekend. She runs in these baggy, shorts kind of thing, baggy shirts. Even the type of clothing that you wear has an effect on the amount of drag that you generate when you move through a natural environment. And so, has there been research that's done on Courtney Dowalter wearing her normal clothes versus wearing some tight-fitted, skimpy, 5K little garment running?
800 meter track athletes
I
trying to,
couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you whether that would have a large, moderate, or small effect on the power output. But according to the developers, it should have an impact on the power output that's being generated. So I think your job as an athlete would be, right, how can I minimize the amount of drag on my body right now? How can I minimize the amount of weight that I'm carrying? If I'm sweated through in a race, or maybe I've done like a river crossing, or multiple river crossings, and I'm carrying an extra kilo of mass, that's going to have an impact on my power output. It's going to have an impact on my speed. But what the power meter won't give you in that case, I'm assuming they are waterproof, so you can run through rivers with them. I don't know. But what it won't give you in that case is it won't know that your body mass has changed. So
Yes, that's
it's going to
such a
continue
good
to give you
point.
power readings based on your pre-race body mass. You're obviously also losing mass as the race goes on. And so there's still going to be limitations, but I think we can learn like good practice, and we can always take learnings from these technologies. So one of the really interesting studies on stride meters has been the effect of device location and inter-unit reliability or variability in measures. So what they did was they took one stride meter and they had them do like a standardized protocol on multiple days. And on day one, they put it on the left foot. Day two, they put it on the right foot. And day three, they put it back on the left foot. Now, when they put it on the left foot initially, they put it at the lower end of the laces, so like right near the kind of toe area. On day two, when they put it on the right foot, they put it on the kind of outer area, if I recall. And on day three, when they put it back onto the left foot, they put it on like the higher end of the laces, and like slightly on the inside. And then on the last day, they took a different device. And so like a whole new stride meter, and they put it back on, let's say, the left foot of the lower laces. And what they found is that there are differences in power measures when you put the unit on different locations. Now, they still found it to have a pretty high degree of reliability. And again, I think it was greater than 95% on average. So we're still looking at pretty good levels of reliability, but clearly sensor placement does have some sort of effect on the power measures that we're getting. And also, what we should be doing from a best practice perspective is we should be using the same unit all the time. We shouldn't be like changing between multiple different units.
So
Like
good.
each person should be assigned. And so because they saw that there's this variability in, I think they looked at things like critical power and mean power output and W prime and things like that, which is like your anaerobic reserve, a very unsustainable force outcome. What they found is that the daily kind of variability in these measures is anywhere between 4 and 10%. And so if you are as a coach, and this is just a normal daily fluctuation, so this is not necessarily to do with reliability, but if you're a coach and you're doing a test and you're saying, right, well, I've measured your critical power today, and it was, I don't know, 400 watts. I'm just throwing a number, 200 watts, whatever. Let's use 100 watts because it's nice and easy for me to do the math. I had you do a critical power test, and there's a number of different test batteries you can do for critical power. We can talk about this when we discuss physiological durability. But I did a critical power test with you. Your critical power was 100 watts. If I went and tested you 2 days later, once you'd recovered, we expect normal human variability in critical power to be around 4 or 5%, even though they're going and they're like maxing out again, they're doing the same protocol. And so if I then put you on an 8 week program, 10 week program, 12 week program, and I test you again, and you have a 2% increase in critical power, I can't go and say, oh, I'm the best coach in the world. I've seen a 2% increase in your critical power. Like, I must be doing something right. We're on the right track, because that could just be
The
daily
fluctuation.
variability in critical power in human beings. And then you throw in the inter-unit reliability or intra-unit reliability. Did you place it in the same part on the laces every time? The smallest worthwhile change appears to be around 4% for critical power. So we need to exceed that if we want to know that we've had some sort of positive effect on your critical power.
That's great.
So there's, again, I can link that one in the show notes. Really
Awesome.
interesting article. It's I'm definitely not like kind of trying to bash power meters in running. I think reliability is the most important kind of metric. If we know that it consistently gives us the same measures, then it doesn't matter if it's slightly over or underestimates the actual power output. As long as I know when I put it on for my race that what I'm
This is the
seeing
same way.
today is the same as when I was testing, then that's useful for me when I'm trying to decide, should I speed up, slow down, change
So
my
good.
pacing strategy.
Yeah, I think that was my whole like kind of hesitant attitude towards it, like is this going to be consistently applied in the same way? Because when I think of myself, I'm like, probably not. So maybe I should have more faith in other people and their kind of durability in terms of wanting to have valid and reliable measures in their own training. So, yeah.
But
Super
that's good
interesting.
practice. And I think that's the kind of thing that is really important to communicate to people is it
Yeah.
is important to keep an accurate measure of your height and weight. It is important to put the sensor on in the same place every time you use it.
Yes.
It is important to do what I would call like standardized training sessions every so often. So you know that you do
Yes.
a set amount of intervals on the track at a set pace, and to explore and examine your power profile to see, is it changing?
Yes.
Am I becoming more efficient or economical at that given work rate?
Yeah.
So these are the kinds of things that I think are important
Yeah. You want to
when
know
you
what do
use
you,
technologies.
yeah, what are you giving credit to? Is it your, is this now like a physiological change? Your aerobic engine has been developed. Is it your critical power? What were you just, did you just get kind of a week of 8 hours of sleep? You just, you want to know like what, where are we measuring the change? I think, I'm just laughing now, Simon. I'm thinking within your own household, it's also with using the same unit. I'm like, if Simon had to go out at his like tall height,
No,
and
I'm
go
not
for a
giving mine to
run.
Yana. I'm
Yeah, I
not
was
giving
gonna
mine to
say,
Yana.
and then
No.
if you give yours to Yana, she's gonna have some interesting developments or like surges in her training. She's gonna be like, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I met so one of the highlights of my conference kind of experience was meeting a researcher named Diego Jayen Carrillo. And he's published this year a paper on stride biomechanical parameters as indicators of running economy and performance, and found that ground contact time, which was developed or derived from, so it's one of the measures that a stride pod kind of gives you is ground
Yeah.
contact time, and found that the ground contact time was the best kind of indicator of running economy. And then they kind of concluded that these can be used. There's also a metric called form power, which is kind
Yes.
of related to that mechanical power output, which is also a good predictor of running economy, as well as vertical oscillation. So these kind of parameters that they provide, they do give us a kind of a good sense of these of oxygen costs at various submaximal levels. And he also did a series of critical power tests on, I think it was Trail. He's in Innsbruck in Austria at the
Yes.
moment. So Trail, I think it was like a forest trail track and asphalt or tar, and they had like set distances on level surfaces. And what they found was that the critical power remained the same. And again, when we say the same, it's within that kind of acceptable, it's under this smallest worthwhile change measure.
Yes.
So if that's
Yes.
4 to 5%. So the critical power in these like kind of highly trained runners was the same in all three conditions as measured by the stride. That shows good reliability. But what they also found is that the actual distance they covered, so the critical speed, was not the same amongst the three
Yes.
conditions. So the theory there, again, the application to trail running is that when you're running on a trail surface, even if it's a level surface, it's more compliant. So your vertical oscillation is not going to, or there's going to be a greater degree of vertical oscillation. Your kind of leg, your total leg stiffness will not be as great. And so you're having to, although you're not running as fast because you're not getting as much back, that elastic energy is not being stored as well, translated
Yes.
through the tar and the track. Your critical power remains the same. And that's because the force that you're having to put in to maintain that peak effort, these 3 and 9 minutes trials that they were doing, we're having to put more force into each step to work at our maximum for 3 to 9 minutes, despite the fact that because the surface is more compliant, the ground contact time is longer.
Yeah.
And so I really think it's like I said, I'm not trying to knock power meters. I'm really excited about the applications, particularly I know that they've got their own algorithms that over a period of a few months will give you a pretty reliable critical power profile just by doing kind of your regular training and putting in a couple of higher effort bouts. And there's some good evidence that the critical power that they derive is kind of within reasonable limits compared to a normal critical speed or critical velocity test. So again, like I think really good innovations in that space, and then just trying to follow best practice in terms of how we use the technology.
Yeah, really cool, Simon. And I think in terms of where do we see this going and the kind of developments in the trail space, like if I think back a couple of weeks ago to Western States, I mean, there's an like it's a very runnable miler, if you want to call it that. I'm like, for your average person, maybe not, but if you're looking at the pro times, specifically the women's field, that's just absolutely hot and fast the whole way through. And I mean the men's field as well, like, but you're just seeing like these small margins are starting to matter more and more within the sport, and that's got to do with a lot of things, you know, development in technology, professionalization of the sport, where people it's opportunities, you know, there's lots of stuff. But basically it's not just a case of you're talented, you've put in some work, pitch up at the start line and you'll do incredibly well, you know. It's like more and more you're seeing measuring my critical power, taking this into consideration, understanding this technology is going to become more important when I'm looking for these marginal gains to earn my, you know, top 10, that belt buckle. And I
And
that's
it does
always
make it more
exciting.
engaging as well.
Yeah,
Like,
it's awesome. Yeah.
if you watch Tour de France and they're doing a mountain stage and you can see how many watts per kilo the leader is putting out going up the last climb, and then
Yeah.
how many watts per kilo those in the peloton are doing. I mean, I don't
Yeah.
think it's going to be long before we have that in
Yes, like
trailhead.
live, yeah, live stream.
And yeah, it is really interesting.
Yeah.
So it's I think there's still, you still want to make sure that you, when you're doing your testing, that you are controlling for as much as possible, and having kind of measures of oxygen uptake, especially for the higher level athletes, is still really important. So you can't kind of get away with that, although there's good agreement between power and oxygen uptake. It's not like that correlation is exact. So the in that study on the validity of stride power meters in measuring running parameters like oxygen uptake at submaximal speeds, there's a positive linear relationship between the power output and oxygen consumption, but the R squared value, which explains the variance between the two, was 0.82. So, in other words, 82% of the variance in oxygen consumption can be explained by the variance in power output.
Yeah.
And so there's still it's not like these are perfect correlations,
Yes.
but when you look at the average person who's using a stride meter, for most people, you're gonna be hitting the right markers. So I just think people must test in controlled conditions still, but then add
Yes.
on the power meter and then say, right, well, what value can I take from this as well,
Yeah.
and how can I? And the main application is in training load monitoring and prescribing speed and intensity.
Yeah.
So that's the real value.
And watch the space, everyone. Simon and his training load monitoring. For those who've been asking, actually, and that's not just a plug, that's real. It is happening. It's coming. We're just giving Simon some space. The fans all have to wait.
I don't know what they're asking for, but hopefully I can deliver on the expectations.
Your data collection in Stellenbosch last year, Simon, it caused us stirrings in the trail running circles. Everyone's waiting for What's
Well,
the
the good
next
news
big
is
thing in the training load monitoring space? What am I missing, Simon? What
I've
am
got
I?
one paper. I've got one paper in the pipeline that should be published not too long from now, and then the paper from last year is near completion. So I'm hoping that'll be
Yes.
published this year as well.
That's
So
excellent.
just hold tight, and
There
Trail Culture listeners will be the first to know.
we go.
So yeah, just keep listening
Simon
in.
Duval will make sure and root it and do it that we all have the edge when we're monitoring our training load. I love it.
I'll try.
Simon, this is super interesting. I went from being not stoked to talk about power to being actually nerding out. I mean, we took it all the way from what it is. We got into cycling, we looked at kind of the strengths, the limitations, where we expect to see it go. I always love these discussions. So thank you.
Yeah.
This is epic.
Pleasure. I feel like we probably didn't even scratch the surface. So if there are people that are wanting to know more, Emily's just figured out how to allow for comments on her podcast. I think we were chatting about that off air. So Emily,
Yes.
just get the comments working, and we can
Yeah, and it sounds
I'm
like
happy
we're
to
all tech
engage
savvy. It's actually a lie.
more.
But yeah, I think as I've mentioned, just to round out that a production break is coming for Trail Culture. This is actually going to be our last episode that we release. It's not big sad, everyone. It's this allows me to there's kind of a backlog of interesting people that I want to get to, of topics that I mean, Simon and I just from this one conference that we want to record and talk about. And it also gives everyone a chance to catch up on everything that's been missed. We've mentioned a few episodes now for people to go back and listen to. So I'm excited about the future and these two tech savvy podcast hosts are even going to try to do a live stream podcast. So you can either
Whoa.
tune in to watch us try and do that, or you can tune in with some questions. We would really appreciate it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm excited about season two of Trail Culture, about the trail science and the role that this plays. And to all the faithful nerdy listeners who really listen to it all, we appreciate you. Yeah, and we'll be back. Our next one is probably gonna be either we'll answer more questions on the power output on a live podcast, and then the physiological durability is coming. Very interesting on
Yes.
over and a lot of other things. So you guys will just have to wait and see. So thanks, Simon. It's always good chatting to
Absolute
you across the
pleasure.
pond. And
Absolute
then
pleasure.
next time we see you, it'll all be live with hopefully some of our guests.
Indeed. And maybe even a in-person episode at the end of the year. We'll see.
Oh,
I'm
yes.
still trying to figure out a way back to South Africa, but we'll see how that
Stu
goes.
McConaghy, if you're listening, give Simon an entry to UTCT so he can have even more reason to come back.
if I come to Cape Town, I'm running UTCT, that's for sure.
Yes, I love it. Epic. Thanks, Simon.
All right, thanks, Emily.
There you have it, everyone. What a great trail science episode with Simon Duval on all things to do with power. We realize that so much of these trail science episodes, it's hard to kind of zoom in, and there's rabbit trails, and there's just so many directions that you can take these conversations in. So we will be doing a lot of work on that side of things for season two and the trail science episodes that you'll find in the second season of Trail Culture. We're really excited about it. Again, any feedback, questions, now is the time. I'm going to be working through a couple of the suggestions and comments from you all. And so if you want to weigh in, now is your moment. I've linked the Trail Culture email address in the show notes, and a DM on Instagram will also go a long way. Thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed this last episode of season one, and I'm really stoked to be back with season two in September. Watch the social media pages for any behind the scenes info, sneak peeks, and also the announcement of season two. Thanks for tuning in, everyone.